normally as we consider reserve fund policy for the state. Today we're doing an overview, and we're lucky to have Ron Parker here from Hampton affiliates, who's done a lot of work with the OBC on reserve funds, and I think heads up their group. And so he's going to walk us through his thoughts and OBC's thoughts on Oregon Stability Fund. Tomorrow we will move into five or six bills related to reserve funds and start considering the different proposals that are out there, working towards a product that we can send to the Senate floor. With that, Senator Starr, any comments for the betterment before we get going?
Nothing this morning. Thank you, Chair.
Paul Warner.
Chair, I'll Mr. Parker. Ron Parker. One thing I wanted to mention about Ron is that he was on the Governor Kitzhaber's tax review task force, and he was a very prominent member of the stability subgroup. And I do have in your packets today that report from 1999, and I think you'll find that many of those recommendations turned out to be prescient as to what was to occur in the, over the next 5 years. So one of their primary recommendations was establishment of a stability fund.
Huh. Well, Mr. Parker, we're delighted to have you here. We're lucky to have your time, and this is, as you have indicated to us in the past, this is obviously one of the big issues facing the state, is having some adequate reserve fund. So thank you for taking a few moments from your Monday morning to help us out.
Thank you, Chairman Deckert. It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate the opportunity to share a little bit of perspective from the business community about a stability fund. And as Paul observed, I have been involved with this issue now for a few years. And it is kind of interesting to look back to that group in 1998 and the work that we did, and see that if we'd responded to that call, we would have found ourselves in a much better situation when the economy went into a cyclical recession. Nevertheless, the opportunity, I think, presents itself once again for us to do the right thing and consider ways that we might improve the public finance situation in the state. And I'd like to just share a few comments about where we've been discussing this at Oregon Business Plan and Oregon Business Council. First of all, as far as the purpose of a stability fund, I think all of you gentlemen understand the purpose for it. I think in Oregon, we could perhaps argue more than any other state, we have a need for a stability fund. No question that public services are vital to the economic stability and health of this state. Yet those public services don't fluctuate nearly as much as our tax base, as we found. And we need those services in good times and bad. And as we'll talk about a little more, no question, we have a volatile tax system. Our state is highly reliant on one source of taxation, which happens to be the most variable tax source that you can rely upon, the income tax. As has been said, most states, in fact, I understand now 47 states have funds to help stabilize their revenue volatility. So we are particularly disadvantaged against other states in terms of preparing ourselves against those inevitable downturns. And while we do have a stability fund, it's single purpose, and it's limited both in size and its ability to help us through those economic depressions. I think business is overwhelmingly convinced that we need a good public sector in order to promote a good business climate. If we are going to promote business growth in the state, we need to know that the school systems are going to be funded, that we can maintain the quality of life that Oregon is so well regarded for. And those services, as I pointed out, we need those both in good years and bad years. They're not going to fluctuate as much as certainly capital gains revenue tends to fluctuate over time. Our volatile tax system has been well documented. In 2002, we had the second largest percentage decline in revenues of any state in the union. We were down 20%, which was even more than California's well publicized 18% decline. We were second only to Alaska in the magnitude of that revenue drop. And that would be hard for any state, any jurisdiction to be able to respond to that. And certainly it caused a great consternation and difficulty for our state. This next slide just points that out again, that we are the most dependent state of any state in the country on one source of tax. Ironically, that tax in our case is the most volatile of any tax, being an income tax. So we're particularly vulnerable, perhaps more state than any other state in the country, to those downturns and that variability in tax revenue. So as you see there, 75% approximately of our tax revenues come from the personal income tax, by far the largest dependency of any state on one tax in the country. And the next slide suggests that part of the reason of that for that volatility is that so much of that tax comes from higher income households, and that higher income does tend to fluctuate again fairly wildly with the recessions that come and go. And as you see in that bottom point there, even though, well, two things. Both capital gains, as we know, fluctuated dramatically, went down 80% from 2000 to 2001. That severely hurt our tax collections. And then even between 2000 and 2002, as incomes went up, even so, tax revenues went down. So the system as it exists is not perfect in terms of providing any kind of stability. And there are a couple different ways to try to deal with that. But one of which I think is within the realm of possibility to discuss today and to hopefully act on in this legislative session. Again, this is just repeating what I've said, that the variability of the income tax, and as you can see, corporate taxes are even more variable, with the corporate taxes declining 47% from the 99.01 biennium to the 01.03. And as you know, many of the businesses in this state are not C corporations, and so I don't know that we really track all of the business tax as being business tax, because it gets taxed as personal income in this state. Nevertheless, those C corporations that are paying that tax, that income fluctuates even more wildly than does personal income. And then the next slide, I think, would be the most important one to reflect upon today. This shows the actual history of revenues for the state going back to 1989 to 91. And more importantly, projects out through 2009-2011. And clearly you can see the downturn that all of you have had to struggle with and how we tried to manage that gap with some one-time sources and have struggled to maintain revenues for the state. What I think as important as anything on this slide is the fact the economy is starting to rebound. We had some good news last week. And the projections suggest that the next couple of bienniums are going to show improvement. This is an opportune time for us to at least set in place a mechanism that will allow us to help stabilize things in the long term for the inevitable downturn, which will come hopefully many years into the future. And hopefully between now and then we can build a reserve fund that is adequate enough to help sustain us from those from that downturn that we will see. As I indicated, there are a couple of different things we could do to approach this problem. One would be to reform the tax system. That's something that a lot of us have talked about and struggled with for many years, and seems to be politically difficult. But yet there is something we can do, and that's to work on the reserve fund and find a way to help stabilize that volatility simply by saving in years of plenty for the times when we don't have as much revenue coming in. And that's why I'm here today, is to talk about changing the way the stability funds works, make it bigger, and make it more responsive to the downturns that we may face in the economy. As I said before, this slide shows 43 states. Paul tells me it's now 47 states that have stability funds. And again, arguably, we have more of a need for a fund than any of those states, and yet we've lagged in our ability to put it in place. And at the height of the economic boom, those states that did have stability funds had 10% of their budget set aside on average. So it's not that suggests to me that it's certainly doable to have a fund of that size, and that may not cover any contingency that we would face, but 10% of the budget to have that in reserve would certainly help cushion the downfall that we might see when other revenues do decline. As I indicated, our stability fund that now exists and was established in 2002 is limited, both in terms of its purpose and in terms of the amount that can be set aside. It's now capped at 5%. which we don't think is enough to help us cushion those downturns. And indeed, other groups, including the Government Finance Officers Association and the National Committee for Economic Development, have both said that states like Oregon need to have a reserve fund significantly higher than 5% of revenues if we want to try to weather those inevitable times of economic volatility. So our proposal to you, or our suggestion to you from a business community, is that you create a stability fund, that you set aside the provision that up at least 10% of the general fund budget could be set aside in reserves. We're not saying that all has to be established this year, but we think now is the opportune time to set up a mechanism so that that fund can be created, that it can grow to 10% of the general fund budget over a period of time. There are different ways of doing that. We don't presume to tell you how to do that. We simply believe that now is an opportune time to do it, and we'll support you as a business community in your efforts to make that happen. We think it is a crossroads time for us to act, and that will help create a more positive business climate in Oregon and help renew the interest of corporations in locating here and for existing businesses to expand.
Mr. Parker, just on that one, I mean, one of the proposals we're going to hear tomorrow, which is not in your candidate sources of capitalizing that stability fund, is Senator Morse and others have been working on a proposal that would use a portion of the kicker to build that 10% fund, and then obviously then it would guarantee the kicker's return post your 10%. Is that something that y'all have explored and thought about? And obviously the other part of that is it has to go to the voters for their
right
approval.
Well, the fact that it needs to go to the voters, I mean, it suggests that it's a hurdle, but it also suggests that that if you can get the voter support, that it'll then be something that you can feel comfortable will remain in place. You know, we prefer not to try to give you specifics about how you get there. It obviously involves some controversy when you talk about the kicker and the fact that it's in the Constitution now. But I think businesses in general are very open-minded to the idea of finding a way to create a large stability fund. And if it's fashioned properly and we can create some confidence that the government really does have its house in order, I think you could get broad support both among businesses and among individuals, even in talking about the kicker. But whether you deal with the kicker or not, I think that there is a mechanism you can find that will allow you to build a fund over time, and that ultimately that's really what we need in the state.
Huh. Well, at some point, I mean, we'll get kind of barreling down this road this week, but we'll ask for a heavy consideration or involvement with the business community, because ultimately if something does end up going to the ballot, my feeling is that you would need to have kind of all oars in the water, and OPC would be one that we'd obviously look to at least say yay or nay to a proposal. So as we work this week, we'll try to forward you what seems to be coming to the forefront.
I'm speaking really for myself here, but I believe that if the legislature produces a package that would create a viable stability fund, regardless of how you really choose to fund that, it would be hard for us as a business community not to support that. We know it's needed. We're anxious to see you take those steps, and we would be, I think, supportive of any effort that accomplishes that objective.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator George.
First, it's a question for Paul, and then back to Mr. Parker. Paul, what is the estimated corporate kicker for this biennium for this year?
Senator George, the new estimate that came out yesterday raised it from $43 million to $60 million. So $60 million is the estimate as of Friday.
Thanks, Paul. Mr. Parker, would your organization support eliminating the corporate kicker and having that going directly into the stability fund?
That's not an issue we've addressed. As I said before, we're trying to build unanimity in the business community, and you clearly get people on both sides of that issue. And, you know, some of whom are very big taxpayers and would stand to be affected by the elimination of a kicker. So it's not something I can tell you categorically we would favor or not favor, but I do think there is, as I said before, overwhelming support for dealing with the issue. However, the legislature feels we best can address that. So I wouldn't rule out business support for the elimination of a corporate kicker, but I can't tell you that categorically we would have unanimous support even on Oregon Business Council or the Oregon Business Plan for that.
Could I have a follow-up?
Yeah, please.
On page 2 of your slides, you have Oregon has a volatile tax system, and you compare us at 20% decline to California's 18. California has every tax you can conceive of, and yet they still had an 18% decline in what is a pretty substantial economy. The taxes that I see you talking about, because you point out on the following page that most of the personal income tax is paid by higher-income Oregonians, and we seem to be losing more of those folks, would be a tax system that would be regressive. It would begin to attack the lower-income part of our economy. Is that what your desire is?
Well, our desire is to try to find a way to deal with the ups and downs of the Oregon economy and the tax revenues that are collected. And as I said before, you can deal with that in a couple of ways. One would be creating an adequate reserve fund that takes excess monies when you're having double-digit increases. And you can see we think we're going to have those in the future biennium. We're going to see year-over-year increases that are pretty significant. And so one way to deal with that downturn would be to anticipate that, as we might have done in the 90s and didn't, and set aside some of that money to help cushion the downturn. Another would be to look at how we source our tax revenues in this state. As I said, we're the most dependent state in the country on one source of tax, which doesn't seem to be a very ideal system. The statistics have suggested that sales taxes, even though they're regressive, and perhaps they are somewhat regressive, don't seem to be as volatile, at least in this economic environment, as do income tax collections. So if your goal is stability, having some other type of a consumption tax or another type of tax might be helpful in terms of helping to stabilize those highs and those lows. Again, Oregon's taxpayers don't seem to be very receptive to a tax increase right now of any kind, and have always shown some resistance to any kind of a consumption tax. If you were starting from a clean sheet and you were designing a tax system that would have stability and be fair, it's certainly reasonable to me, and I think reasonable to many of us in the business community, that a consumption tax would be part of that. Nevertheless, we have a landscape that we need to deal with that tells us what we may and may not be able to do, and we don't think a consumption tax right now is likely to be very well received. We can still deal with the problem that we're facing, though, through a stability fund, and that's where our focus and our effort is in coming down here today.
One follow-up.
Yeah, please.
Thank you, Mr. German. A few years ago, I saw a study that was done on states that had the stability fund, and Paul says now we're up to 47 states who have stability funds. The interesting thing was that back at that time, it was about a 50-50, and those who had stability funds seemed to always grow government slightly faster because there was not the downturn in which they had to focus on efficiency. Are you afraid that that will be the net result? We're having trouble right now with a budget crisis getting anyone in this building to look at efficiency. I mean, it's just almost impossible to try to push that straw uphill. And so I'm concerned that, business downturns in the business community normally results in streamlining, productivity increases, and all those sort of things. Are you afraid that that opposite would occur if you had a stability fund? Government would have no reason to reform and streamline and become more efficient.
Well, I think that's a valid concern, Senator George, and it's one that we've been concerned about at the Oregon with the Oregon Business Plan as well. I'm sure you're familiar with some of the things that we've talked about, but creating more efficiency in government, trying to restore confidence in government's ability to spend tax dollars wisely, has been a very important aspect of the agenda that we've been promoting for several years. And we think long-term budgeting and really reprioritizing the way public money is spent is critically important. I do believe some efforts have been made from what I've seen and heard from the governor and from the legislators as well. I think some efforts are being made to become more efficient in the way taxpayer monies are spent. But you're right. if you have a system that doesn't provide an incentive for government to always be looking using a sharp pencil in analyzing the budget, I think the business community would have some concern. I think there are ways that the fund could be structured, though, and we explored this back in 1998 to not give government as much of an encouragement or incentive to grow more than they can. You can make the mechanism for withdrawing money from the fund such that it can only be done when there truly is an emergency, and encourage government to still be frugal, because in order to tap the fund, you have to have strong evidence of a downturn, and there has to be a critical need for the money to come out of the fund. So I think you can put in provisions that will help protect you in that regard, but the caution is an appropriate one.
Thank you.
No. Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Parker, actually, Senator George had a question I wanted to ask, and he did the first one, because that was the first thing I was thinking of. Is it seems interesting to me that with the strong support that we have heard over the number of years about the nexus between the business community and education, it would seem to me to be an obvious answer that a corporate kicker should in fact be redirected to the stability fund to ensure the services that make business productive, which is what we hear all the time. So, I just find it rather interesting to think, well, we may not, focus on that, but that's exactly what we hear all the time, is that we need to invest in education, but kind of that age-old question, but we want others to invest. We want to give the message, but don't ask us to make the contribution. I mean, isn't that kind of a contradiction right there?
Well, perhaps, but I think it's also fair to say that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't know that the corporate kicker is a big enough number that in and of itself is going to solve our stability funding issue. And so you could take all of the corporate kicker and still have an issue of how are you going to maintain this fund going forward. And because there are fewer, well, let me just put it this way. Many of the businesses in Oregon are set up as subchapter S corporations as opposed to subchapter C, suggesting that even though they're businesses, they're not going to be penalized by the elimination of the corporate kicker. So you're kind of picking on C corporations if you say we're going to eliminate the corporate kicker, but we're not going to do anything to the personal kicker. I mean, you start to divide the business community when you pick out one segment of business taxpayers and suggest that they're going to have to forego the kicker, whereas another segment may not be similarly penalized.
Okay. Mr. Chair. Yes. Another point on the stability fund. Help me with this a little bit, and I certainly concur with your assessment of the need for the stability fund. But sometimes I kind of wonder if we're almost, talking semantics here. We actually have a stability fund, and your organization was helpful in pushing that. That's the Educational Stability Fund. So, and since 57 cents out of every dollar goes to education, essentially, how many stability funds do you really need? I mean, why not raise the cap of the current fund we already have to 10%? Because if you spend that money on education, that frees the money for everything else. And maybe politically, it's not as hard as creating yet another fund. I mean, to me, that would seem to be, if you got 10% of your general funds stuck away for certain economic downturns, whether you call it the economic or whether you call it a state stability fund or the current educational stability fund, it's going to go the same way. I mean, by the time you pull the dollars out and apply it, I just kind of wonder if politically that it may be easier just to change the cap as opposed to trying to create, quote, yet another fund. I just was curious as your thought on that.
Well, Senator Metzger, as I indicated in my testimony, if we simply do raise the cap to a number that is going to really provide some stability for that fund, I don't think you'd get any brushback from that from the business community. If that is the best answer that you think you can come up with in terms of addressing the need for stability fund, then I believe the business community would be there to support you. As you say, education is the most critical component of trying to provide some stability over time, and as long as we do raise the cap to a number to where it can be more meaningful, I think we'd be there to support you.
Yeah, I just one final.
Yes,
and I guess the thing I would be thinking of is, it would be, it's not just, of course, raising the cap, but it would be identifying other resources to go into it. But in terms of creating a whole new legislative animal, I was thinking of raising that cap and then directing these new resources, whatever those agreements would be. I just think what might be an easier way to get to the same result, not that I disagree with the other, it's just that the realities of the building would seem that we could maybe get there with a little shortcut.
I hear what you're saying, and I think the business community could be supportive of that approach.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Reicher. Further questions? Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
We, I think, failed to get your name on the record from at the beginning of your presentation.
Okay. My name is Ronald C. Parker. I'm the vice chairman of Hampton Affiliates, a lumber company here in the state. I'm also the co-chair of the Public Finance Task Force of the Oregon Business Plan.
Thank you very much. Appreciate very much your presentation. Mr. Warner, what's next on the agenda?
Mr. Chair, next I have a
bunch of slides we can't read.
More slides here to go through with you. And really to build on some of the points that Mr. Parker raised and to establish background for tomorrow's consideration of stability fund bills that the chair pointed to. We actually have four of them tomorrow. They're all SJRs, and then there are some accompanying statutory language which we haven't scheduled yet but will for next week. I've got several things in your packet. The first is a ranking from Governing Magazine. It gives Oregon a C+. I'm not sure what that means, but in terms of the commentary there is some things that are relevant in terms of a rainy day fund and stability fund issue, really echoing the points that Mr. Parker raised. If you look at the third paragraph down there, it says the other income tax reliant states have been able to soften the blow of these shortfalls with some kind of rainy day fund mechanism. And then it goes on to somewhat disparage the Education Stability Fund, citing the fact that it has been, most of the dollars have been withdrawn shortly after the fund was created. And of course, that had to do with the fact that the fund was established during the middle of the recession. So that was one of the things that that the chair had asked me to point out and look at how some of these general outside organizations rank Oregon, and the stability fund issue is one that has come up a number of times, not only here but also in terms of commentary we've received from the bond rating agencies, for example, tend to look at the reserve funds as a criteria for looking at stability. The second piece of material is a review of Oregon's tax system policy recommendations. What I've done is copy some pages from the governor's tax review and the policy advisory committee from the stability work group that Ron Parker was a part of. And again, keep in mind the interesting thing about the observations here is that they were done in 1998. And so they do pretty much anticipate what was to come. It cites the state's growing reliance on income taxes, cites its sensitivity to economic conditions, and then says the state has no formal mechanism for dealing with unanticipated revenue shortfalls. Its number one recommendation is the creation of a stability fund, and that's laid out on next to last page is actually page 21 of the report, but next to last on your document. Under solutions, the committee recommends that Oregon establish a stabilization fund. And just some of the criteria that are laid out should be statutory, which is you'll be looking at constitutional as well as statutory changes. Of course, the 2% surplus kicker was not in the Constitution at that time. That wasn't until 2000. Certain economic criteria, we'll talk about that. Once the criteria are met, the reserve fund should be used with legislative majority. It does also talk at somewhat length about the point that Senator George raised, which is the fifth bullet point there. The committee said that the reserve fund should not be used to eliminate all budget cuts during difficult economic times. It should be used along with budget cuts. The cuts should try to preserve core services. The governor and legislature should be given flexibility prior to our services. So, in fact, it goes on to argue that each dollar in replacement spending should be matched by an equal budget cut. So it's suggesting a one-for-one use of the reserve fund versus budget reductions in a budget shortfall. Finally, the last point to make, and this will come up, and as particularly as we discuss this issue in the House, which we'll be doing this week as well, if you look on the start of that second section, it's actually about the fourth page in. It's page 18. There's a table there for long-term and short-term stability options. And there was quite a bit of local government involvement on this group as well, and you can see some local government recommendations. But under state and short-term, the first was established a stability fund. It's also interesting, as recommended, if a shortfall anticipated, enact a temporary tax increase, well, if necessary. But the long-term, one of the long-term consideration is revision of the appropriation growth limit, which was in place at that time, and that has been since changed in 2001 with our current statutory spending limit. So those issues were brought forward at that time. And now what I'd like to do is go ahead and walk through with you some further background to tomorrow's discussion. First of all, we talk a lot about recessions and the business cycle, and sometimes I think it's helpful to look at exactly when they've occurred and their severity in Oregon. There are different measures of the severity of recession. Certainly on the revenue side, this last recession was the most severe we've had in the post-war period, and we've seen the numbers on that in terms of percentage decline. It is also only the second time in the post-war period where we've had 3 years in a row of declining employment. That was 80, 82, and 01, 03. So those two recessions were the longest in the post-war period. Certainly in terms of job losses, the one we went through couldn't match the 80, 82 period. So that was a very severe. Actually, at the national level, it was two recessions with a very short expansion in between. We don't see any evidence of a recovery, really, at all in Oregon. It's basically a prolonged three-year downturn at that time. Notice the two mild recessions here in 91 and 75. These both tended to be swamped by in-migration. They're both periods of rapid population growth, and that population growth was sufficient to overcome, or at least to neutralize somewhat, the effects of the national recession. What may be more typical, and in many ways, looking at some of the employment numbers here, these recessions of the 50s may be more typical of what lies ahead, with job losses in the neighborhood of 2 to 4%. And notice also that you've got a period here. Here's a five-year, three-year periods of in-between recessions. So one of the uncertainty is, as we look ahead, is you've got a very prolonged period in here without a decline. There was actually a recession in 69-70, but there was no actual job loss in Oregon on an annual basis. So a prolonged period here, and then, of course, another really prolonged period of 20 years here. So the bottom line is we don't know when that coming recession is, but if you look at a pattern from the 50s, it may be probably prudent to anticipate in a 5 to 7 year period we would have a business cycle run its course, recognizing that factors can change that timing. The other point to keep in mind about Oregon's economy, we've had a lot of discussion about how the structure of Oregon's economy has changed, and it has significantly, but one feature has stayed the same, and that is that Oregon is a goods-producing state rather than a service-producing state. And what we've done is look at manufacturing as a percentage of the value added in Oregon, and notice that from 77 to 2001, that percentage actually went up a little bit. Whereas the country dropped from 23% down to 14%. So the country's become much less manufacturing-oriented than Oregon has. This manufacturing sector, particularly the capital goods component, is highly sensitive to the business side. So again, that leaves you with kind of the problem statement in terms of a stability fund, that a goods-producing economy is going to be dependent on these external markets. Oregon's competitive position is going to be very important relative to other states and other countries. But number one, it's going to be cyclically sensitive. So while we can make the case, and I think a pretty strong case, that the national economy has become less cyclically sensitive, recessions tend to be milder. Certainly the federal government was very aggressive in trying to offset the effects of this recession. Oregon, relative to other states, is going to be more sensitive because of the makeup of our economy. And again, in terms of the income and sales tax and the fluctuations we've seen over the last 10 years, you can see the income tax drop during this recession, whereas the sales tax growth is considerably less out here, but the drop is considerably less. So again, the sales tax volatility that was raised earlier shows up in the national data. This is another chart that you have seen, which is goes back as far as we can go. It goes back to the creation of the income tax back in 1929, approved by voters in 1930. And you can see that the volatility we've experienced with a huge boom during the war years and the immediate post-war period. But we've enjoyed pretty rapid revenue growth throughout this period of 20% to 30%. Here's the drop in the 1980s. Then you see growth of around 20%. These are all biennial numbers. And then the drop down here. And, of course, the issue for you as you look ahead in terms of revenue policy is, how typical is this going to be? You know, if this is going to be typical of the future, then the stability fund issue becomes a very prominent one. As we've said, there are 47 states that are listed as having a rainy day fund. Oregon has the Education Stability Fund, and these are the key components that have to be the key issues that have to be determined for all of all stability fund proposals. My suggestion for you is, as we look at these different alternatives, is to score them in terms of a number of criteria that they all have to have. One is it constitutional or statutory? And you'll be looking at constitutional changes tomorrow. Of course, any adjustments to the Education Stability Fund will be, by necessity, constitutional. We'll have to change that basic structure. What are the revenue source or sources going into that fund? And we've looked at some candidates on that. And again, tomorrow you'll be looking at things like 2% kicker reform, for example, lottery dollars that are going into the current Education Stability Fund, raising that percentage, or finding other sources. Stability funds tend to have three different triggers, and I lump them into three categories: economic triggers, budgetary, and political ones. Economic triggers tend to revolve around changes in employment and payroll employment. Unfortunately, we don't have good timely data on the overall state economies. Unlike Canada, the Statistics Canada produces a pretty good rapid turnaround on provincial gross provincial product. We don't do that in the U.S. We get personal income data, which is not very reliable. It tends to be revised significantly. And the most reliable short-term data we get is the Employment Department's payroll survey. And that's usually put in there as the economic trigger. But there's others you could use, certainly, that could be indicative of economic conditions. Or you could develop an index like the state economist has. He has a leading index. There's also what are called coincident indexes, which measure economic activity based on a series of indicators. The other set of triggers are those that are budgetary. And by budgetary, it's either some measure of a shortfall, for example, percentage decline in revenue relative to what the budget is. And the other triggers tend to be political, which usually have to do with the voting requirements, like, for example, a 3/5 or a 2/3, what it takes to get into that fund. uses of the fund can either be limited to certain areas or they can be general purpose. And you'll see proposals both ways. Most general stability funds are basically at the discretion of the legislature. You come into special session, you can access the fund, and then you would go through a budget process just as you do each biennium. And nearly all funds have some type of a cap in which they are used. So if we look at the Education Stability Fund, and again you'll have actually two proposals tomorrow to change the Education Stability Fund. First of all, it is constitutional, and you more or less went that route because it was an adjustment to the Education Endowment Fund, which was in the Constitution. The revenue source is 18% of lottery earnings. And this revenue source is an interesting one because we've kind of gone back and forth on what its long-term implications are. We have assumed traditionally that lottery would grow more slowly than general fund. And that what that means is, with the cap that's currently in this, is you will, in effect, if you raise the cap, you'll never catch up if it's a percentage of general fund. Because if general fund revenue is going to grow faster than lottery, then you'll never put enough in the money to catch the cap. However, lottery continues to have a life of its own. We now have a major proposal to expand and increase the amount of gaming activity. That, of course, will boost, as long as that percentage stays fixed, will boost the stability fund considerably. And we've also been doing a lot of analysis and looking at what's the long-term growth rate for lottery. It appears to be closer, particularly with the video, closer to what you'd expect to see from any product or service, that it's going to grow pretty close to the rate of personal income. Now, we think that income taxes and the general fund will still grow faster, but we don't think the gap is as great as we once did. So this revenue source should grow over time as long as that as long as gaming activity continues to the extent it is, and now with a broader base, that should continue to happen. The other thing about this revenue source that we've learned over the last 5 years is that it's very stable. We saw very little decline in lottery activity, no decline in lottery activity during the recession. It's a very stable revenue source and something that's going into that fund. The triggers that are used in the Education Stability Fund, to access the fund, requires a three-fifths vote. I mean, that political trigger is there for any decision to draw money out of the fund. And you may recall that last session you had a finding that the bill essentially said that there was declining employment. There was two consecutive quarters of declining employment in 2003, and that we were 2% below the close of session forecast. So that finding was a statement in your bill that was approved in June of 2003, and then the three-fifths vote in both the House and Senate. It was originally a Senate bill to withdraw money out of the fund, so it can be either House or Senate bill in its origination. There is another provision in the Education Stability Fund that the governor can come forth and declare an emergency without these other criteria, these other findings in terms of budgetary declines or economic decline, and get the three-fifths vote and therefore access the fund. So it isn't restricted to those findings if the governor declares an emergency. But the one thing that is always required is a three-fifths vote in both chambers. We've talked about the fund size at 5%. When the fund was established, even as we were declining somewhat and we first started looking at the Education Stability Funds in early 2002, you may recall there were two ballot measures. The first was defeated. The kind of rule of thumb was 5%. And 5% was seen as the typical impact of a recession to knock you 5 to 7%, usually below trend. So a 5% fund was felt to be reflective of what you would need. That, after the experience of the last recession, that's been revised somewhat, and I think most people would argue that this fund perhaps should be larger. And that's why you're seeing some proposals come forth in the last session And again, now you'll see proposals to raise this cap above 5% or create another stability fund that would be complementary to this one. And then, of course, the uses of the fund in public education. The Education Stability Fund has been used to fill the state school fund. That's how you've used it, but there's no restriction on that. It can just be public education. So it could be higher ed, community colleges, or whatever type of education expenditure. The other proposal that I have here, and this is one that you will see tomorrow as well in its current form for this session, but this is the one that you approved last session in the Senate, and this was SJR 2 and Senate Bill 5 is the original Senate Bill 5.
The baseball bill.
This was prior to it becoming the baseball bill. Reserve fund proposal was under consideration, you approved, modified the 2% kicker calculation, actually made it converted into a 1% calculation above forecast, and diverted those funds into the fund until the fund was filled. So the thing about the kicker, and you know, you'll have this debate, I'm sure, but it is quite a different revenue source, almost the opposite of the lottery. Whereas the lottery is kind of a continuous, stable stream, the kicker is going to be erratic and sometimes big, sometimes non-existent. So it's almost the reverse in terms of that flow and its predictability versus the lottery. The fund, the triggers that were put into the bill are identical to the Education Stability Fund. So that's something you may want to review as well, to see if they want to make some different types of triggers. But it's really designed to be a complementary to the Education Stability Fund. The cap is set at 10%, and once you reach that 10%, once you reach the 11%, then you begin to return dollars back to the back in the form of the current kicker law. And there, the terms of uses of the fund uses are general purposes, and they're not restricted to education. So that would, again, be something you would come into a special session and then allocate the dollars as you would any other revenue source. So that's the background material, Mr. Chair, and in preparation for your discussion of the bills tomorrow and then next week as well.
So. Questions? Looks like we're set up for some very interesting discussions. And Mr. Chair, you missed a very exciting presentation here.
So that looks like my timing was perfect. We're
any questions, Senator Decker?
Last frame.
Presentation. Yeah.
This will be the work that we do this week is to sort through. So tomorrow we'll get just about all the different ideas presented to us. And it sounds like Paul's teed this up pretty well, so we'll just start going through them and trying to decide the viability of each of the different proposals.
One thing I should mention on the revenue source, and I don't really have it here, in terms of the current Education Stability Fund, one of the kind of unusual features is that the fund doesn't retain its interest earnings, which most funds do. But as you recall, the Education Endowment Fund had uses of those earnings that were in statute and used for paying lottery school bonds and also for needs grants. Of course, those earnings have dropped off as the fund was used for current purposes. But the Education Stability Fund does not have earnings retention provision, and that does affect the growth over time.
So are they just going into the general fund?
Those dollars are allocated statutorily. They're still allocated 75% to the bond and 25% to the needs grants. But the dollars coming from that, because the principal, a lot of it has been used, is much smaller than we anticipated it right. being.
Anything else, Paul?
That's all I have, Mr. Chair.
So this is Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. We'll do Stability Fund. Thursday, we're off Friday, is everyone going to be at our affordable housing field hearing in Portland on Friday?
What are the plans for travel? Do we have those set up yet?
We could. I guess we could get a van.
What time?
Yeah, the guidelines are for us to get a van. We can talk about how you'd like to do that. I know a number of you are up from that area, so if you want to stay up there at the end of the day, or
and a few of us aren't. If I need to get a car, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that when we went down for transportation.
Well, we'll probably do some sort of van or some sort of, because we'll have to bring up all the equipment. So the goal is hopefully we can all be there on Friday. We're going to have, I think, hundreds of folks. We're going to look at the affordable housing tax credit, the one that we have and proposal. They have to expand it a little bit, the housing community does. And then we're going to hopefully vote out, go into work session on our amnesty and vote that out Friday also, assuming that Dexter gets us the full amendment back Tuesday or Wednesday.
Mr. Chair, we do have a work session scheduled on Senate Bill 480 for Wednesday. Mm-hmm. So you can actually first time to see that amendment, and we can work through that and talk about we'll be working in the next couple of days to put some numbers on that, so you'll see what that revenue impact estimate will be, and then you can discuss that, and then if there are any changes that need to be made, hopefully we can have those to you by Friday, so we'd have the bill ready to go.
Yeah, that's good. Okay, so we'll get it all prepared Wednesday, and then the other issue Friday is they've talked about if folks are interested in a lunch right after our hearing at a site, one of the new affordable housing sites close by, and so they would do a quick lunch and a tour right after our hearing if folks are interested. And I told them we'd get back to them today on that.
So our schedule then is we're going to meet from what time to?
9 till noon, and then we'd have lunch. You'd be done by 12:35-1 on Friday. Yes, Senator George.
Are we going to be able to broaden that a little bit? Because I've had a complaint over the weekend from a person that has been tracking the revenue that is not being generated to local government because of the tax breaks that are granted to low-income housing. And the person was saying the actual cost for the housing is not less, yet there's a substantial tax break. Do we have any way to review that and determine whether or not that's correct? And I will get back to this individual and ask him if we can get a report. Would they be welcome to come and talk about that? Because
absolutely, and that'd be a good time to ask these folks because they have a whole presentation for us on how well this has worked. But I think a good question. I think we should ask a lot of tough questions about has it really worked that well? And before you're asking us to not only extend the tax credit but expand, we want to make sure that it's doing what it's supposed to do, which is really provide incentive for private and federal dollars to come in and build these housing complexes.
And it would actually help with the affordability issue relative to those who need that support.
They should all be there Friday. I mean, I know that they're bringing folks from all over the state in to talk to us about how they utilize it. So I'd welcome a critic or two of how it actually works.
So I assume Bob Repine and company will be there?
Yeah, I mean, I think the state housing, and then we're going to hear a lot from the private, the banks. I mean, first will be obviously the recipients and the folks that govern the program, and that would be the housing folks. But then the second will be from the folks, the banks and the others. They actually use the tax credit. They market it to what they say is provide that gap funding to make it where they can pencil it out and make a few bucks. Senator George.
You know, a couple of years ago we passed vertical housing bill and we gave a lot of subsidies to folks who were living in apartments that are valued at $750,000 or more. And a lot of people are just really, that's starting to rub them wrong as the amount of tax abatement that we've given to some folks that surely seem to be able to pay their own way. Is that going to be part of the discussion to take a look at that? Because you're going to be looking at, some of the tax breaks we offer, some of the tax expenditures.
Yeah, Paul, can we bring whatever? And last week we did spend 2 days, and we're going to come back to this. We've got a work group that's working on urban renewal, which is very similar to the discussion was very similar of are you accomplishing what you hope with urban renewal, or are you subsidizing and giving tax expenditures or moving incremental financing around? And so I think we'll get recommendations. That's where I think you were unfortunately sick That's where we spent 2 days last week, was just on Urban Renewal.
I have the DVDs, though, so I will be watching.
Better you than me if you have the DVDs of those hearings.
Well, Senator Decker?
Yeah.
What Senator George says is really good. This thing is still a rather complex issue as far as I'm concerned in terms of analyzing that, and why I appreciated our discussion last week. And to the extent that we can have some real arm's length, knowledgeable critic available, so we'll have everybody who benefits from these, the banks and everything. It would be nice if there is somebody, and I don't know who that is, maybe Paul or others, who can ask questions because of their knowledge that would help that interchange. That would be really helpful, I think, Friday.
I totally agree. I don't know if there's, I mean, there's folks, if Senator George, if you know of one, mm-hmm. I would definitely welcome. I'm thinking maybe the Cascade Policy Institute, too, who has looked at some of these. I would welcome having a person or two or a panel come in and give us the other side. Now, what we're looking at is the Affordable Housing Tax Credit, but we can kind of reach beyond that a little bit and look at, well, here's the other subsidies that are in place, except for Urban Renewal, which I think we've spent a fair bit of time on. Senator Brzezinski.
Mr. Chair, I think when we're setting our overview of agenda for the committee, one of the things I suggested, and maybe this is going to get us there, is tax expenditures. I mean, we've got 355 of those. I don't think we're going to be able to have a day or two session on it, but it sure would be nice to maybe set some time and that we can actually start looking at these, because I've got some objections to piecemealing this process. Mm-hmm. I mean, I understand Senator George has someone that wants to focus on one thing. Mm-hmm. I don't want to see us trying to take this on in that type of perspective, as compared to, if we're going to do it, let's do it all of them, and let's have a review of what's before us, what was the intention of all of them, and see which ones are working, which ones aren't.
Yeah,
make adjustments once we get the overview of all of them, not piecemealing it.
Mm-hmm. No, it's an excellent point. I mean, the reason that we've teed this one up for Friday is because it was a good one to travel with.
Appreciate
it. We'll spend, and I think we've kind of got it off into, which is the right way to do it, in April or late March, because you want to do it towards the end of the budget cycle. But we'll take all of the credit ideas that there are, and we'll have this discussion of, here are the credits, and we'll spend 1 week probably just working on, well, here are the bills that either extend credits or new credits. Here are ones that would sunset some of the credits, and we'll have that whole kind of broad discussion all in one place. And the bill that we hear Friday, we'll just take and put it into that discussion.
Excellent.
That we have, and I think we're scheduled to go not till April on that.
Was that April 15th, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, that's a good time.
Or April 1st.
We'll meet at the post office in Portland at 11 p.m. on April 15th.
Thank you. We are adjourned till Tuesday.